Last time, then, we began to see how well in advance of Christ's first coming, when he was born of the Virgin Mary, that God began to prepare the entire world for the arrival of his church. And we talked about how Babylon brought the concept of world rule, and God began to use these pagan empires not only to fulfill prophecies given by Daniel, but in order to prepare for the New Testament church. To establish world government was Babylon's contribution. Then we talked a little bit about the Persian period, in which a different concept was introduced. Not only did they have a government control of the world, they had a different philosophy. They permitted their conquered peoples to retain their religious practices, and in fact permitted them to spread their religious practices to a degree throughout the world. It was the concept of the Persians to allow religions to exist in that maybe they thought the gods would all be pleased. They didn't want any gods to be angry with them, and so they permitted all the pagan religions of the world, as well as the Jewish religion, to exist and even to flourish. And as the Persians permitted the Jews to return to their homeland, not only did they return to their land of their origins, back into Judea, many thousands of Jews chose not to return to Judea, to Jerusalem, and to take the Jewish culture and religion throughout the Persian Empire. The name that the Persians applied to their concept was called cultural pluralism. I'll try not to overly bore you with certain technical terminologies, but at least you should be familiar with some of them. Cultural pluralism, that is, they allowed many different cultures to exist within their own culture. And you might stop to think what it would have been like to preach the gospel of the kingdom of God in the Roman Empire in the days of Paul and Peter, let's say, had they had no basis for it. But the Jewish religion had long since preceded them, and this skips ahead a little bit in a thought we'll come back to, but it's interesting to note that for the first, 30 years in round numbers, 25 years of the New Testament church, the Romans didn't even know there was a new religion in the world. They thought it was Jewish. And that's an interesting concept we'll come back to a little bit later. So that the Jewish religion permitted the Christian church to be firmly established in the Roman period that was to later come. No doubt God had a lot to do with this. The Jews during the Persian period, in order to retain their own culture, established a whole system of worship. You know, prior to the Persian period, the Jews and their religion only existed in Judea, or the Middle East specifically Judea, Jerusalem, as its headquarters. There was no need for anything to occur anywhere else, interestingly. But in the Persian period, when they were dispersed, how were the Jews going to retain their identity? Of all peoples in human history, the Jewish people have never lost their identity. Most others have. Many of you, of course, are from heritage of European or whatever descent around the world, and you've lost it. I have some German blood. It's gone. I have no idea where it originated, what my peoples in Germany were like. The same is true of my Welsh blood, my Irish blood, my English, and my Scottish blood. And many of you are about the same as I. We're a pluralistic people in America, at least today. Some of you who are from other nations may know your heritage for some generations. Most of us in America, Canada, even Australia probably, have lost our heritage. The Jews never did. The Jews didn't lose their heritage because when they got out into the empire, they had to come up with a method of preserving their religious culture. You see, they knew from the prophet Jeremiah, and to a degree Ezekiel, that they had been sent into their captivity because of their sins, because of Sabbath breaking, because of idolatry. And in the Reformation period of Ezra and Nehemiah, of Joshua and Zerubbabel, the Jews determined they would not let that happen again. Of course, it was in a carnal way, we all realize, but they nevertheless had a certain resolve. And in that period, in order to retain their religious heritage, as well as their national heritage, the Jews, as they moved into these communities throughout the empire, remained in colonies, in clusters of people, and established the synagogue worship system. Not previously been done. When in Jerusalem, in the days prior to the Babylonian captivity, the religious services were all centered at the Temple Mount. And they did not have the system of religious weekly worship in the way synagogues developed. So in the diaspora, that is the dispersing of Jews throughout the Persian Empire, the synagogue service developed. And by the time we come to the New Testament church, those synagogues were, of course, firmly a part of life. And you'll remember that this is where the Apostle Paul, and to a degree maybe a few others, always started any, or almost always started their new work anytime they went to an area. They went to the synagogue. So those synagogues for a couple of hundred or more years, three or almost 400 years, in fact, in some cases, been established and in place. And that was how the Apostle Paul was able to take the gospel to the world in his day. So that's the Persian contribution to the preparation of the New Testament church, one that few people recognize, it seems. We then come to the Grecian period. Beginning around 330 B.C., of course, Greece's own culture was developing. From the days of Socrates, we come into the time of Plato and Aristotle, the great Greek philosophers, and of course it was in this period of time, the early Grecian period, that the educational and the cultural system we attribute to the Greeks came to its full fruition. The Greeks gave the world culture. Certainly the Babylonians and the Persians didn't. The Persians were a very uncultured people, very warlike, militaristic. The Greeks, while they certainly had a powerful military without a doubt, brought the world culture. And in fact, the culture that we generally speaking in the Western world have maintained to this day. In education, in art, music, language, education, I may have mentioned that, we have furthered the cause of the Greeks. So God was not totally opposed to everything they did. I think sometimes we can jump up on our bandwagon and scream and shout and get a little carried away by it. Now, I don't subscribe to the philosophies of Plato or of Aristotle or of Socrates, but we must remember these are carnal men, not led by the Spirit of God. But in their own way, their contribution has influenced the carnal world we live in, and we retain to this day the systems that they gave us. For example, what we're doing right now. I am standing before you lecturing. You are seated before me listening to me lecture. This is what Plato did. He gathered his students around him, and he sat on a hillside outside of Athens or somewhere wherever he was, and he lectured to his students. And that's what we do to this day. So it's not all bad. The Greeks brought culture, civilization, art, and education, language. And, of course, as you well know, God was preparing for the New Testament church to preserve the New Testament writings in the Greek language. I will not at this point discuss any reasons as to why God may have shifted from Hebrew to Greek. That's for another class at another time, and I'm not sure I fully understand the answer myself to give it in a one or two sentence simplified form. But we all know in advance that Greek was the language of the New Testament. It was the language of the New Testament writing, at least, if not speaking. And the New Testament scriptures were preserved for us in that language, and so education and culture became a very important part of how the New Testament church would be established. And in the Grecian period, the world was diffused with this learning. Pardon my voice, it's for some reason or other going on me. The language was diffused and it became the acceptable language. Interestingly enough, later in the Roman period, the Romans retained Greek as the language of education. While Latin, of course, was the language of the empire in the Roman period. Anyone who was educated spoke Greek. You know, Paul, remember when he was arrested before his trip to Rome, spoke to the centurion in Greek. And the centurion was astounded because he had also learned Greek. And he was astounded to learn that the Apostle Paul was a citizen because he had bought that with a great deal of money, but Paul was born a citizen of the Roman Empire. But Paul was educated in the Greek language and in the Greek classics and in the Greek poets. So some of you who studied the classic languages of Latin or Greek, or you have studied classical literature to fulfill your education requirements as opposed to maybe English or American literature, you have those options, I understand. So try to keep up with it in every case. If you've chosen to study the classic literature, you have studied some of the material that was preserved originally in the Greek language, interestingly enough. Greek philosophy gave civilization a sense of importance, and it brought a humanitarian approach. It took centuries to develop these things. The Babylonians and the Persians had little regard for human life, but the Greeks did. The human being became much more important. I'm speaking as a carnal world now. You see, God uses the carnal world. He doesn't change it. He allows His people to function in it. Always has. We are not to be part of it, but we must function in it. And so God prepared the world through allowing these kind of things to happen. We may condemn humanitarian or humanism in that sense of the word in certain ways. We certainly may not agree with Greek philosophy or any other philosophy. We can probably pick it to pieces from a theological point of view. But when we understand its setting, that God had prepared the world for the gospel of the kingdom of God, it had to come in that kind of a realm. Just as in today, God did not choose a Russian peasant in 1917 to begin to lay the foundation for this era of the church, because that Russian peasant who might have later understood the truth and grown in it in the same way Mr. Armstrong did in the 20s, could that Russian have launched the preaching of the gospel of the kingdom of the world from Moscow or Vladivostok in 1934, let's say? Well, if God were going to use the carnal world in which we lived, it couldn't. He didn't do that. He rather prepared a man in the democratic, free world, and in fact the most affluent nation, or the one that was to become that in the free world, to proclaim the gospel of the kingdom of God in these years. I think it's good for us to see the parallelism of God preparing the world in that day for Christ in the New Testament church in the same way He prepared the world in our day for the gospel of the kingdom of God to go to the world. We should not lose sight of that analogy. So the Greeks brought us a philosophy of civilization, of the importance of man, and they continued to allow the Jews to live and prosper in the Greek world. And so many Jewish communities prospered. In Alexandria, down in Egypt, for example, the Jews essentially established what would be a diaspora headquarters of Judaism to compete even with Jerusalem in the minds of those who were not residents of the Holy Land itself, in its import, its scholarship, its libraries, its university. Down in Alexandria and in Egypt otherwise, were very important. This is where the Septuagint was translated into the Greek language, that is, the Old Testament of the Bible, translated into Greek from the original Hebrew Scriptures during this period of time. So you see, the foundational change was all being laid during the Grecian period. Antioch, up in Syria, had become the second most important city in the empire, after Athens, and then later in the Roman period, Rome even, but in the east it was the most important city, and it was to be from Antioch the New Testament church would launch its work, more so from Antioch than from Jerusalem, that is, to the Gentile world throughout the empire. So all of these things were being prepared, you see. And then finally, in the middle of the first century before Jesus, in the 60s, as we call time, B.C., in the 60s B.C., the Middle East fell to the Romans, who had been in the meantime growing as a great world power. In the 60s, the Roman general Pompey, or Pompey as some call him, led his armies into the Middle East and took Syria and Egypt. And, of course, the Holy Land fell. And now we come to the Roman period. The Romans had begun to rise, as I've already mentioned, in that first century before Christ. But we, to pick a date, establish the beginning of the Roman Empire as 31 B.C. It's not that Rome was not a very important power for years before that. They were. In the days of Pompey and Julius Caesar, the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the world came under Roman dominion bit by bit. Julius Caesar concentrating much of his effort in Europe, all the way to Britain, Pompey before him in the Middle East, and old Julius Caesar himself had gone that way too. He was assassinated, though, you know, in the 40s, and Rome was in a state of some confusion until finally Octavius became Caesar and in 31 B.C. defeated his arch-rival Mark Antony, and the Roman Empire is solidified under one Caesar, Augustus, in 31 B.C. And it was under the reign of Augustus Caesar that, of course, Jesus was born. And the whole polities of the empire were established. So from Britain to North Africa, from the Atlantic to India, the world had been brought under Rome in that century or half century before Jesus was born. And by the time of the birth of Jesus, there was at least a modicum of peace throughout the empire. The areas or territories that had been occupied by the Romans were now at general peace, although there were always rebellions and insurrections here and there. The Jews themselves never really knuckled under. But by and large, we would say the world was at peace. The Latin term was called the Pax Romana. The peace of Rome had been brought to the world. So Rome dominated that territory, as I said, from Britain to the Sahara in North Africa, and from the Atlantic Ocean all the way to the borders of India. And within that empire, they allowed citizens to live and to maintain, as long as they were peaceable, self-government. So that you had a system of government established from the Roman Caesar down through senatorial rank proconsuls that occupied important government positions out in the empire. And under them, there were kings, and under them, there were governors. So you had a whole structure of government. But the kings and the governors were usually local people. For example, in the Middle East, I think you're all aware of the name of Herod. Well, should be aware of Herod. That is, the Herod who was responsible for government as king of in that Middle Eastern Syrian Judean area at the time of Jesus' birth, Herod the Great. Herod had been appointed king by the Romans about 40 B.C., 37 B.C. The date's not important in this class. Around that period of time. But Herod was a local, in that sense of the word, an Idumean who had lived there all his life and had obtained a great and powerful position. And his family maintained that position for a long, long time afterward, even, through many, many others, through many years that were to follow. So Herod came to the kingship, and that was very important to the establishment of the New Testament church, and you know a little bit about him because the Bible talks about him. Rome ruled the world within that system of government. Now, the Roman policy of government, to use the fancy political or technological term, was called laissez-faire. You may have read that in your political studies of the past. I'll write it on the board, because it should be a term that you're familiar with. L-A-I-S-S-E-Z-F-A-I-R-E. Laissez-faire. It means let them alone, essentially. People rule themselves. And as long as they stayed loyal to Rome, that is, they paid their taxes and didn't rebel, this is the government that was set up. The laissez-faire government of Rome permitted people's self-government. They permitted people's freedom of their ancient religions. Interesting concept in Rome. They permitted people's freedom of their ancient religions, but they forbade the establishment of any new religion. It was contrary to Roman law and policy for new religions to come into existence. But they permitted all these other things to happen. It was very interesting, as I've already commented, because, you see, we all view, and the world views, what Jesus Christ established in Pentecost of 31 A.D., or on Pentecost in 31 A.D., as a new religion. Christianity. a totally new religion. And in many ways, of course, it was. But the Romans could not perceive, looking at it outwardly, that it was a new religion. Why? What did the Christians do different from the Jews? As far as what you might observe, very little. See, Jews didn't offer sacrifices in Athens and Antioch and Alexandria. You only offered sacrifices at the temple in Jerusalem. Jews worshipped at the synagogue. Jews worshipped on the Sabbath. They didn't eat unclean meat. They paid temple taxes and or tithes. They observed their annual holy day festivals. What did the Christians do differently? A lot of people never thought of that. The Christians didn't all of a sudden change the day of worship, begin to observe the Saturnalia as a symbol of Christ's birth, observe Easter as a symbol of the ancient Isis and Osiris, changing the day of the Passover, of the Jewish holy day. Christians did none of that. Didn't change anything. Christians didn't eat pork. Christians did, as far as you would observe, what Jews did. They worshipped, even in some cases, at the very synagogue, or next door, remember the book of Acts, to the synagogue. Or as a result of the synagogue meetings, the Gentiles came the next Sabbath, and the next Sabbath, to meet with the apostles. Sometimes they then hired their own hall, or met in people's homes. This was what the Jews would do too. They might on some occasions go out to the seaside where prayer was wont to be made. This was the Jewish community in Philippi, you remember from last semester. The Christians did nothing to be of a major determination different. In the Gentile world, they ceased circumcising their boy babies, but no one would generally know that anyway. These things all were not knowledgeable enough to the Roman community that they could perceive a tangible difference in the first 25 years. And by the time they did, if I can use the term, it was too late. And we'll come to, of course, in a couple of more classes, what happened in the time of Nero. When he finally did begin to persecute the Christian community, it was already so established, so large, that whatever persecution the Romans threw at it, it could not stamp it out. If it would have happened in the first few weeks, months, or even years, the Romans would have decided they weren't going to permit this to occur. It would not have been hard, carnally speaking, to stamp out Christianity before it ever got started. Execute the 12 apostles and it's over. See? Or whatever. The apostle Paul would have been forbidden, would have been imprisoned 25 years before he was, it would have been over. Now, God obviously did not permit that, but you see how God works in the normal carnal world. He didn't do anything special, that is, visible special. He did not open the heavens. He did not force the Romans. He just let it grow on the basis of what had already been occurring. Interesting concept. And you think, that's important, I think, because even in our day-to-day, people expect things to happen a little bit differently. God lets us with money go out and purchase time on the television. He lets us write and publish our literature. He does not crank the presses for us. He does not pay the bills for us, other than he inspires the thousands of people to support the work through the normal channel of doing business in this world. Maybe someday God will change that. I rather doubt it, because that's the way he's always done it. And we must be prepared for that. So the gospel of the kingdom of God went in the early Christian period to the Roman world. That's where God caused his work to begin, to flourish, and to grow. That was prophesied, that is, the Roman government was prophesied from the days of Daniel. It is estimated that of the total world population, Rome controlled approximately one-third. See, they did not go much further than the Sahara into Africa. They did not cross the borders of India into India and Asia. And the New World, of course, was so far over there nobody knew it existed. And the Indian populations of the Americas were not under Roman rule. But one-third of the population of the world was under Roman control in the early Christian period. So this was what Rome allowed. And Christianity, as I mentioned, was never viewed until the time of Nero in the 60s. So it started in the 30s. It was into the 60s before Rome became aware of what had happened. And still, I'm not sure there was that much discernible difference between Jew and Christian as far as the Romans were concerned. So the church was permitted to take its message to the world during that period of time. I think an interesting observation can be made of what Rome contributed to the culture of the world and to the stabilization of the world and what it did. I don't have a textbook for this class because I don't know of one that really gives us the material that we want, but I will refer from time to time to key works. Just so as students of church history, later as you discuss these things, when names are mentioned of authors or works that are notable, you at least have heard them and they're in your notes and part of you. Perhaps in modern times, the best known church historian is a German who lived late in the last century and early in this century, that's late 1800s, early 1900s, named Adolf Harnack. H-A-R-N-A-C-K. Harnack is regarded as the modern father of church history. Now, you may hear that term relevant to other men of long ago, but in a modern sense of the word, Adolf Harnack is the one who really cataloged and brought into volumes the study of church history. So you should be familiar with his name. He wrote in German. Many of his works have been translated into English, but not necessarily all. They are available in our library. Several different volumes of Harnack's works are available in our library. And at the turn of the century, he wrote his church history work that is regarded as classic. It is The Mission and Spread of Christianity in the First 300 Years, in the English translation. The Mission and Spread of Christianity in the First 300 Years, or the First Three Centuries of the Christian Era. And Harnack analyzed, and again, this is somewhat from a carnal sense, but I certainly think that it should be noted, that there are seven major reasons for the ability of the Christian church to spread in the Roman period. Seven major reasons. Three of them I've already touched on, but let's list them so that, again, you have a sort of sense of what a traditional church history approach would be to this. The first, and these are Harnack's seven reasons for Christianity's spread, or for the spread of Christianity. Number one is diffusion of Judaism. I've commented on that, I think, enough already. That the Jewish religion had been spread in the period of Persia, first of all, prospered in the Grecian period, and was solidified by the Roman period, and there were colonies of Jews in not only major cities, but in many cases, minor cities throughout the Roman Empire. So that virtually any place the ministers of the New Testament church went, and they were almost all Jewish at the start, you know, even including Paul, they were able to start with the Jewish community wherever they were, whether Athens or Corinth or Philippi or Thessalonica or Berea or Laodicea or Ephesus, wherever. Almost everywhere there were communities of Jews throughout the empire. Second reason Harnack notes, and again I've commented on it, that is the Hellenization of the empire. Hellenization means the Greekization, but you don't say Greekization, you say Hellenization. It sounds better for some reason or other. From the Hellespont, the Grecian area. The Greek culture spread throughout the empire. I've already mentioned language, culture, philosophy, education, art, and so on. And the permission of these religions to continue of ancient times, also in the Grecian period.
We're picking this up down in the radio studio to make up for some deficiencies in the classroom, so the sound quality you notice for this one small portion of a tape might be radically different. We're talking about seven reasons that Christianity grew and developed in the Roman Empire in that day. And we had come to point number three, a very important part, that there was a Roman world monarchy. That is, in the Western world, under the Romans, there was one world government, one system of law. And while that system certainly was filled with its normal human imperfections, we have the beginning basis of our whole Western legal culture that begins in this period of time. It united people in thought, it protected people, and many of you will, of course, remember the utilization of that law in the early New Testament. One utilization of it, as we have talked along in the class, has been that the law provided for the promulgation of an existing religion, but prohibited the establishment of a new religion. The church could develop because it was perceived to be, as we have noted numerous times, only an extension of Judaism. It was not seen in any visible way to be that different, as far as any of the Romans could concern. And of course, perhaps the most famous incident of using Roman law came in the ministry of the Apostle Paul, when on trial for what happened in Jerusalem in the middle to late 50s, he appealed to Caesar. As a Roman citizen, this was his right. And even though he was of no special prominence, although he certainly was not of a lower class stock of people, he was permitted the appeal or appellate right up to Caesar himself. And so God's church could use the Roman world monarchy, its centralized government, its standard unification of law from throughout the empire. That will bring us to the fourth statement of Harnack, an observation of how and why the gospel could be proclaimed in this period of time so effectively, and that is that the Romans had developed a communication system, a very interesting communication system and travel system developed by the Romans. Primarily, the Roman road construction that had begun a half century or more before the time of Jesus was built to permit the Roman armies to move their war machines and troops throughout the empire. This gave the Romans a decided advantage. They could move their equipment on roads that even to this day in some cases still exist. If you travel to certain sections of the world in the Middle East, from Italy, especially on eastwards, even as far as that goes up into Britain, you will find to this day the remains of Roman roads. It's one of the more famous things to photograph in certain sections and to walk upon, and it is quite an emotional experience to be standing there where these armies and military equipment from so long ago moved up and down the roads. However, when the world was brought into its confinement by the Roman military, and there were no new places to conquer, so to speak, the borders of the empire were essentially solidified, this road system provided a means of travel. And of course, there were two things that were encouraged by the travel in roads, and that was that the common man, to a degree, could move freely about, although it was expensive to travel in those days. And there would be a system of commerce and trade, and that caravans could move from one end of the empire to the other, even from without the empire, spices from Orient, the Orient as an example, or from the depths of the African jungle, certain kinds of exotic animals could be brought up for the benefit of the Romans in their gladiatorial fights and that type thing. So you have a whole system of essentially empire-wide communication and travel that now is available. And it's obvious when you read the New Testament that this system was immediately put to use. And it, of course, was the primary means of the Apostle Paul being able to take the gospel throughout the world, or the Roman world at least, in his time frame, of trade and commerce that made it safer at least than some other means of travel. Now, Paul did state that he was in danger from time to time of highwaymen and robbers, and there were those things that they had to worry about, but the Roman military still had stations and outposts throughout the system, and it was as safe or as good as it had ever been. And one interesting observation about communication and travel in this day, because the Romans used not only land travel, but of course sea travel, that as far as any major or significant improvement in travel and communications from the time of the Romans, which even predates the birth of Christ, the next most significant development in transportation and communication does not really occur until the middle of the 19th century with the invention of the steamship that plies the seas so much faster than the old sailing vessels. So this significant change in communication is a very interesting one. And as we noted in an earlier talk, God had prepared the world for the New Testament church through the development of the world-ruling empires, beginning, at least from a prophetic sense, in the days of Babylon, continuing through to the Roman period. Now the church could take the gospel to the world through the best means ever possible in all human history. And now we look at what happens in modern times, and we see no major and significant improvement on travel and transportation until just a short time ago. And by the time those systems were developed, and we came into the age of the automobile and then the airplane and into our time today, giving time for modern technology to develop the means for the gospel to go to the world in our time, what an interesting parallel that God prepared the world for the apostles of the early New Testament church, and that there was no major significant improvement in ability to get around or to communicate until his Philadelphia era of the church was to take and proclaim that gospel of the kingdom of God to the whole world. Before we leave the communication systems, we should also take note that the Romans had developed a reasonably intricate postal system as well. And while compared to our modern postal systems and speed and efficiency it was not much, we do note that the Apostle Paul, especially, as well as others, used this postal system to communicate to the churches. Letters were written, epistles or theses drafted, and were carried sometimes by personal courier, other times perhaps within the system itself. But we distinctly see that style, that development, and that the New Testament church took full advantage of the postal system. Just as in God's work today, we take full advantage of the technologies and the government's opportunities, regulations, to do the work. And so we use the postal system, we use trade and commerce, we use travel and communications to proclaim the gospel in much the same way the early New Testament had done in the time of the Romans. That brings us to number five. We note that there was a humanitarian ideal in the Roman Empire during this period of time. Perhaps the Romans had developed from the Greeks this basic humanitarian concept. And we have talked a little bit about the tolerant attitude about religion. The Romans did not try to do away with religions of native peoples within their homelands. It was essential to the Romans that the peoples of the world honor the Roman gods or respect them, and especially gave honor to the Caesars or those who proclaimed themselves to be gods. But essentially they were tolerant, and their attitudes about religion did not force any kind of persecution. And in fact, it was not until the 60s, really at the time past Luke's conclusion of the book of Acts, for example, that any major or significant persecution of the Christians begins to happen that is a result of Roman attitude or aspect. Persecution from the inception of the church was essentially Jewish until the time of Nero and the burning of the fire at Rome, which we will be talking about in this class a little later. So the humanitarian ideals of the Romans were very important. This generated questions about man's importance, the purpose of man, and Christianity, of course, purported to answer some of those questions, and it was intriguing. You'll remember Paul's discussions philosophically at Athens, that people wanted to hear what this man had to say. And sat and listened to him, although not many were converted, at least shows the tolerant attitude pervasive among those philosophical castes within the empire. And as we've already mentioned, Christianity could now grow because it did not appear visibly, certainly, to be any different from Judaism. That is, they were Sabbath keepers. They observed the holy days. They did not eat unclean meats. Many, of course, even continued to circumcise their boy babies and so on. So there was a tolerance that was there, and that brings us to point number six, which is an extrapolation of humanitarianism and furthers that tolerance of religion. So point number six is that Romans tolerated religion. Point number five had to do with their humanitarian ideals. Now in point number six, we've been talking how the church was viewed as a sect of Judaism. This proves that the church's doctrines that we hold that are considered Jewish were certainly in effect. If the Christian church, for example, had immediately established new holidays in observance of Christ's birth as a substitute for the Saturnalia, Brumalia, in December, if they immediately had begun to worship on Sunday as the day of Christian worship, if they had instituted Easter celebrations to commemorate the resurrection, if they had abolished the Jewish practices outright, they would never have been permitted to grow. It would have been stamped out of existence from the very start. So almost all scholars agree that the earliest of the Christians were, in fact, more Jewish than Christians relevant to practice, and certainly that which you could visibly see. So in Judaism, you would have Pharisees and Sadducees. There was the Roman loyalists called Herodians. There were the Essenes, a very strict religious sect, out on the Dead Sea region. And there would be Nazarenes. This was the newfound Christian movement, but it took years before it to be called Christian. And that was in Antioch, not in Jerusalem, where that name was applied to the church. And it would be nothing more than some of these other names, such as Sadducee or Herodian. Nazarene would be just a common part of it. Those who followed that Jesus of Nazareth, who after all was a Jew. And we have finally the seventh point, which may not have as major import as the others, and that is the diffusion of the Assyrian and Persian religions that had already taken place throughout the empire. Now this becomes important maybe not so much for the development of God's church, but it is very important to the development of a whole false religious system, which we'll be talking about, that really begins in the time of Simon the Magician. That is recorded in the book of Acts, and there will be a number of things we'll be talking about in this class relevant to that. This was made in part possible that in the period of time we call the pre-Christian time, the Assyrians and the Persians had disseminated their own religious philosophies. Persians had emphasized religion and had allowed all religions to exist. Remember, it was under the Persians that the Jews were permitted to return to Jerusalem, rebuild the city, and rebuild the temple, and to reestablish their practices. The Greeks had brought the world the concept of polytheism. Now in the empire, we have the ancient Persian mystic religions, which was a religion of the soldiers, the military, that had been disseminated throughout the Persian Empire. And the last vestiges of these old Persian religions really lingered on for centuries, if you get right down to it. Because they were carried from the eastern extremities of Iraq, Iran, Persia, of course, being Iran, outward past the borders of Greece, through North Africa, throughout what we call the Holy Land, Asia Minor. The Persians had their religious mystic symbols. Now, in that context, we have Greek, we have Jewish, we have Roman, we have Babylonian customs. All of these things have been perpetuated. And a word that you will hear from time to time about what happened in the early Christian period is syncretism. That's S-Y-N-C-R-E-T-I-S-N. Modern derivation of that word would be synchronize, to blend together. What we have happening, and the development of the false church is here important, and there'll be a lecture on that. Simon the Magician and others of his ilk syncretized, that is, they blended together lots of different concepts into a modern religious philosophy. And the fact that the Persians had disseminated their sort of mystical religious system, and the Romans had had theirs, and of course you have the pantheistic Greek system of gods, the polytheistic worship of the Greeks, and the Romans had perpetuated that, you come to a blending as a result of these diffused religious philosophies that had come during that period of time. So the diffusion of pre-Christian religion is very important to more the development of a false Christianity that is going to take concepts, pagan beliefs, and add it to Christian and stir in some Jewish and then add some new thoughts. And this is what is going to become what many people view as the Christian church, but it is certainly not the whole church of God. And that brings us to the subject of Simon the Magician and who he was. So we'll let that suffice for this time and have another lecture next time.